Welcome to Between the Lines with Tristan and Jake. Here at Ferg Sports Bar and Grill in America's number one local sports bar as voted by USA Today. We are in our Body Armor Coca-Cola studios, and we will be live every single Sunday morning from 11 to 12, covering the best of the NFL, college football, and baseball, from the minors to the majors. I'm Tristan here with my co-host Jake. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Between the Lines Show and TikTok at Between the Lines Hour. Now, let's get into the first segment.
What do we have today, Tristan?
It's a hot take segment. We do this segment every week. We share our hot takes with each other, and we share them with you. And we see what everyone's thoughts on them are. And what's your hot take this week, Jake?
You know, I went first last week. I want to hear your hot take first this time.
Okay, that seems fair. My hot take this week is, I don't know how hot it is. It's a little lukewarm, I would say, at this point. And I did make these notes at the end of, or in the middle of the week. But it's about the Dolphins. It's about the Dolphins and Tua Tagovailoa. I think the Dolphins need to move on from Tua Tagovailoa if they want to see success in the next five seasons. He's an interception machine. He forces the ball into places it doesn't need to go. He makes just overall bad plays. And he looks like a rookie. Like, the plays he makes look like a rookie. He does not look like a five-year veteran. And the reason I thought that was a hot take and it was reasonable to give was partially because a lot of people are still pretty high on him, surprisingly. Although, you know, people talk about his time at Bama. People talk about his first two seasons in the NFL before the concussions and all the injuries and stuff that he's dealt with. I think the Dolphins, if they want to see success, they should move on from Tua Tagovailoa, whether that means starting Zach Wilson, looking for another option at quarterback, drafting a quarterback. I'm actually seeing a lot of people saying they should draft Arch Manning, but he's not looking that good.
Arch Manning won't declare, but we'll talk about that later when we talk about college football. Now, what I'll have to say about that is, for me, I don't think you can give up on a quarterback in the National Football League anymore. When you take a look, you see guys like Baker Mayfield, Sam Darnold, Daniel Jones, Geno Smith. They do it every single year. They come in, they resurrect their careers, and I think it's all about the organization. When you take a look at that Dolphins team, what do you notice when Tua goes into the press conferences? And same with Mike McDaniel. They are all slouched over. No one seems excited. Tua has mentioned multiple times that players just skip meetings, even if they're mandatory. Optional, I doubt even a few players even show up. I think it's a complete culture thing, and I think every single organization in the league needs to focus on getting their team morale up. And I think if Tua and the Dolphins can do that, I think Tua will go back to those first 2 years that he had as a quarterback. But I also think if he goes to an organization that, you know, has a little bit of a better culture, Tua will be completely back on that top half of the league quarterback, maybe even top 10, maybe top 5 eventually.
Definitely. And I mean, you see it firsthand in with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The locker room aspect and the attitude of the players is so crucial. Jason Light continuously talks about it. Todd Bowles continuously talks about it.
Baker Mayfield, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, even the players talk about it, which is very surprising, because in a lot of franchises you see guys that are individual. They play for the name on their back, not the name on the front. But it does really seem that everyone that plays for the Buccaneers enjoys playing for the Buccaneers, and they take pride in it. And I think that's something that is a hallmark of successful NFL teams, teams that make deep playoff runs, is guys that they contain guys that really do love the place they play for, what they represent, and just have a good culture in the locker room. What's your hot take, Jake?
I'm going to get into my hot take here. And my hot take is that the Bucs don't have a single weak player at any position. Whether you include Kalijah Kancey being injured, whether you include Cody Mauch being injured, the backups that have stepped in have played in such an amazing role. Even Cervosia Dennis has completely turned his season around. I think every single player on that Buccaneers team, whether they're a starter or a backup, if they're playing in the game, I think they have a reason to be on that roster, and I think they're a good player.
I could see eye to eye with that, and I think that would make sense. But if that were the case, I think the Bucs would be undefeated right now. You know, I feel like any team that has a strong player every week at every position. Even the
it's just the
backups.
Simple mistakes that are the reason we have one loss. It's the missed punt, and then that completely took around. You know, the morale of the team was kind of down in that first half against Philadelphia. That's the difference between that loss and all of our other wins.
Definitely, but there are a lot of different formations, and there are a lot of different asset groups that you use as a coach. And so I feel like it's hard to say that when, you know, in some defensive looks, there's, you know, like Deion Jones out at linebacker, which he has been very poor this season. Because think about it, when you have a three linebacker defense, you have Lavonte David, Servassier Dennis, who have both been, you know, consistent this season. But then you have guys like, you know, stepping in like Deion Jones. I think that third linebacker is a very big question for, you know, that Will linebacker is a very big question for the Bucs defense at times. And I don't know. I think any team that could have like security to the full at any position like that, like I said, would
like the Bucs do at receiver.
Yeah, no, like that's a good example where the Bucs have insane depth at wide receiver. It seems that even though there's major injuries to what would normally handicap a normal NFL team, the Bucs are able to. They kind of have a revolving door of talent there that the that obviously Jason Light put together, but they can fill in the gaps when Mike Evans or Chris Godwin are out. And I think that's one of the reasons why they took Emeka Egbuka in the first round.
I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves on the draft here, but I think there's an Ohio State receiver the Bucs might be looking at in next draft too. But you know what? That's a conversation for another day.
I don't know if
Mike
Evans
and Chris Godwin are getting old. If they both retire, I mean, it's certainly a possibility, but
I don't know if the Buccaneers would draft two wide receivers in the first round back to back years.
But I'm just saying, nobody thought they would pick a receiver this year. Who's to say they don't do it again if they lose two of their
best?
That
would be a little crazy, I feel like. If they realistically speaking, if they took Jeremiah Smith in the first
round. Not Jeremiah Smith. Jeremiah Smith will not fall. I can't quite remember his name, but there's a kid on Ohio State who he's good.
Mm.
And, I mean, if we're going to be picking from pick 32 like we all hope, and like it kind of seems right now like we might be picking, even if it's just close to there, it seems like that might be a possibility. But let's move on. We are both wearing jerseys.
All right.
I want you to go first.
So the jersey on my back this week is Baker Reagan Mayfield, the quarterback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He is an absolute beast. He has showed this season that he is an MVP contender. I have some stats for you through week six, through six games. This is week seven. He is the MVP frontrunner in the league. That is not just me as a Buccaneers fan saying that. He legitimately is the MVP frontrunner. He has had 1,539 passing yards, 12 touchdowns, a 66.2 completion percentage, 77.1 overall QBR. And just for general notes about his gameplay, he looks much more composed than he did last season. Last season there were some moments where he shoved the ball into places that it didn't need to. He maybe felt the pressure, or was trying to extend plays, make big plays happen, and just couldn't every single down. But
the interceptions have been an extremely impressive thing. The only interception he's thrown through six games is a tipped ball. I mean, yes, I believe that tipped balls are quarterback's fault, but even in that scenario, it's just so impressive.
Yeah, without a doubt. And he looks much more calm behind the pocket, surprisingly, behind the injured offensive line. Not saying that the offensive line has much to do with it. I believe that he's still settling into this position in Tampa, although he's been here for a few years. And he's finally really feeling like he has the reins to the offense. His scrambling and play-extending abilities are better than ever.
It's so impressive. Watching him run when it matters most, the fact that he's able to just run through guys, I mean, when I'm watching him this season, it really does remind me of Josh Allen. Mm-hmm. The ability for him to run through guys, play so tough, and the way Josh Allen, I feel like it's kind of how Josh Allen did. You know, he started off his career, you know, well, we won't start there, but the last few seasons he's had a lot of interceptions. In the last, I think, 2 years now, he's really cut it down, which is what Baker Mayfield is starting to do this season.
Yeah, when you compare Josh Allen's, Lamar Jackson's, and Baker Mayfield's passing stats, like, they're really, like, Baker Mayfield surpasses both of them by a mile. But the thing is, you know, their rushing stats are higher. And
I just believe Baker just takes the runs when he can. Lamar gets it designed to him. Josh Allen gets designed a little bit. Not as much as Lamar, obviously. But it's still a scenario where the Bucs don't want Baker to run, but they are confident when he does to the full extent.
Yeah, and something that needs to be talked about with Baker Mayfield's playmaking ability with his feet is his runner vision. And what runner vision is, like, for those who are listening at home may not know, it's your ability to read the defense down the field when you're taking the ball and running it. And that's what you see out of the best quarterbacks in the league, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson. That's what you see out of the best halfbacks in the league. You know, Devon Achane,
Bucky Irving. The way he's able to juke through people is crazy.
Yeah, and you can tell the direction everyone's coming. You have a good sense of where you are on the field and what's going to happen, what you can realistically make happen. And he's had a great sense for that this season. He's looked like an MVP, and that's the bottom line. That's really what he is right now. What about you?
I'm going to get into my jersey here, and I'm wearing number 56 for the Tampa Bay Rays. No longer a Ray, but forever a Rays legend, Randy Arozarena. And I want to read you his stats here in the 2020 postseason. He hit .377 with 10 home runs, which included an ALCS MVP. And get this, he holds the record for most home runs in a single postseason, and he is the all-time home run leader for the Tampa Bay Rays in the postseason, concurrent throughout all seasons.
He holds the record for the entire league for home runs in the postseason?
In a single postseason.
In a single postseason?
Yes. 10 home runs in a single postseason is the all-time record.
I did not know that.
And then also, no Rays player has hit 10 home runs in all postseasons combined. Evan Longoria has 9 throughout his career, but no Rays has even had 10 throughout their entire career, and he did it in just one postseason.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, I was always big on Randy Arozarena. I loved Randy Arozarena. I remember the day he was traded away and he sat in Randy Land. And
I have a vivid memory, and yeah. it's bad.
It's just, sometimes big players, you do got to let walk. I still don't necessarily agree with
that
decision.
Imagine what we would have done with him.
Yeah, but
I mean, it's just,
you know, the Rays
the
are on the,
is so weak.
The Rays are on the path to, I would say, general success, especially under the new management of Patrick Zalupski and his group. And I think that it's really nice to reminisce about the past and look back at, you know, all the records that Randy Arozarena holds or, you know, any of those guys from the last couple of seasons that were just so fun to watch on the field. But now we have Junior Caminero, right? We have guys that we can look forward to watching. You know?
So good. Junior Caminero is an unbelievable baseball player, and he's only 22 years old. We'll talk more Rays later, but
getting into the MLB postseason a little bit, this is a discussion that we have both kind of had behind the scenes a little bit.
A lot of conversation. And yeah, we'll talk about that Dodgers game after, but since we're on the topic of Randy Arozarena, I want to talk about this Mariners Blue Jays series. Any takeaways you have from it or anything that you want to share?
Not off the top of my head. I've liked the brand of baseball Seattle's playing right now. They're playing a very offensive. They really are an offensive juggernaut, and it's showing up in this postseason without a doubt. You can see anytime you turn on the TV and there's a Mariner up at bat, they're swinging for the ball, and most of the time they at least make contact.
Kyle Raley has had
an insane postseason.
Unbelievable season. He's undeniably the MVP.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's absolutely nothing else to it. You can argue Aaron Judge, but you really can't. At the end of the day, I mean, you can say that it's a regular season award, but even in that scenario, I'm taking Kyle Raley 100 times out of 100. You know, he played platinum glove level defense. Somehow wasn't even nominated for a gold glove, which is insane, but that's a whole nother story.
Mm-hmm.
But anything that you get from the Blue Jays team, I mean, the way I'm seeing it, these Blue Jays they're fighting. They get a lot of hits. They've got a lot of scrappy guys on their team. You know, Nathan Lukes, a former Ray. You got Dalton Varsho, who's had a really good postseason, hasn't had as great as a championship series as he would have liked. But even guys like Isaiah Conner-Falefa or Addison Barger have had, and even Ernie Clement, you know, they have a lot of scrappy guys who are really underrated, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing really, really good with what they have. I think, and I actually heard today that in the World Series, the only team that realistically they say might have had a shot at beating the Dodgers were the Phillies. What are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think that the Phillies were the best shot at beating the Dodgers in the World Series at the end of the postseason, or do you think, you know?
I did see that conversation a lot when the NLDS came up. I did see that, you know, people were saying that the Dodgers versus Phillies was really the World Series, and we were just lucky to watch it. But I'll tell you this, the Phillies have been so disappointing to me. Every single season, you know, you go in, they've got absolute superstars on both sides. You know, they've got Bryce Harper, they got Trey Turner, they've got JT Realmuto, who's kind of losing a step, but he's still a good player. They've got so many phenomenal superstars on offense. And then they've got guys like Christopher Sanchez, who really stepped up. Former Ray traded for Curtis Mead. Mm-hmm. Horrible trade, but you know what? It looked like it was going to be good. We won't even talk about that.
I almost feel as if the Phillies had made it to the World Series, they probably still would have choked. In the World Series.
I have that feeling, too. It just feels like the Phillies, just every year, they get to the playoffs, they have a good game or two, they really make people think that they're a good playoff team, and then they kind of just go down and don't really show anything else. They just have these, you know, one-run, one-to-three ball games, and then they get, you know, maybe two hits in the eighth inning to make it look like they have some life, and then that's just it.
Yeah, I mean, they haven't stood the test of time yet at all.
And Kyle Schwarber's a free agent. This Phillies team really might be on the downward trend. You know, yeah. Aaron Nola's getting. I think Aaron Nola might have said that he's retiring as well. That might have been after next season, but it's getting close.
Sure.
Zach Wheeler's starting to get old. I believe he's 34 or 35.
Leave it to two Rays fans to tell you about how the Phillies are falling apart. By the way,
yeah, absolutely. Now I want to ask you, how about the Dodgers and Brewers series? You know, obviously, we both have one takeaway from that. But anything else before we get into that? Because we could talk about that all day.
I mean, there's just...
I think it was just unfair.
It's just unfair. You know, if Tyler Glasnow is your fourth pitcher, and then Shohei Ohtani, your starting pitcher, has a game like he did, you know, people are considering it the craziest athletic feat that has ever occurred. It just isn't fair.
It was Dodgers by a landslide. I don't think anybody but maybe Brewers fans really believed that the Brewers were gonna win that. I mean it's just the Dodgers are a juggernaut of a team, and I think the Dodgers' entire starting rotation, when healthy, is better than the Brewers' entire starting rotation.
I had a lot of faith in Jacob Mizrowski, and I thought he was going to show out much more than he did.
Yeah, he's a young kid, though.
Yeah,
got to give him time,
of course. Yeah, that's what I was about to say, is you can't expect a kid like that to put the whole team on his back. You know, like, really, he did everything he could.
Now, before we get into talking about Shohei Ohtani and his amazing game, I want to ask you this. Dave Roberts, after the game in the NLCS kind of celebration on the field, he had this to say: let's get four more wins and really ruin baseball. What are your thoughts on that?
I hated that. I hate that. I hate that
so much. To me, you know, it seems like, you know, it's confusing for me, because a guy like Dave Roberts, he doesn't even really have a say in, well, he does, but it's not more of, he doesn't quite sign these guys, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not the one that creates the budget, or, you know, neither is the general manager, but he's not the guy that goes out and offers these contracts. It's the general manager, so that's kind of where I'm like, stay in your own lane.
Yeah.
You know, if the general manager said it, you know, it's one thing. If the owner said it, it's one thing. If the owner said it, now that's something I could actually, I could get behind that.
If there has ever been more of a time for the baseball, like, I don't want to say like new gens to argue that there should be a salary cap. It's now.
Yeah.
It's now. Because if you have a team that's built upon Shohei Ohtani, Mookie Betts, Blake Snell, Tyler Glasnow, these gigantic names that normally...
Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman. You can go on and on all day about this.
Like, it's just... There really is only one, like, if you look on paper, there really is only one team that should win the World Series every single year.
Yeah, and it's the team that spends the most money, and it's the Dodgers.
Exactly.
Now, I do want to give the Dodgers a little bit of credit here before I ask you a question about the Brewers. Now, the Dodgers, I do want to give credit because they do a phenomenal job developing talent, as do the Rays. the Dodgers just don't get enough credit for it because of the fact that they spend so much money on these guys that it kind of just seems like, oh, well, they just bought him and he, you know, obviously he played good. But, you know, you take a look at a guy like Alex Vesia, who, you know, has always been a solid MLB player, but they've really taken him to this next level. And it kind of reminds you of what the Rays do, you know, with a guy like Brian Baker, who was having a solid season before and then, you know, really as of late turned it on in the last half of the season.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a question for you about the Brewers. Now, there is rumors going around that the Brewers might be wanting to trade Freddy Peralta because of the fact that he has an $8 million option and the Brewers wouldn't want to pay it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? You know, going back to the Dodgers and spending so much money, do you think it's worse for the MLB teams to kind of take the Rays or even the Brewers route of, you know, spending as little money as possible and developing talent as best as you can and hoping you can win? Or taking it as the Dodgers, as you can spend as much money as you have and, you know, just putting the best juggernaut of a roster out?
I think that the Rays, I keep going back to the Rays, but the Rays are such a good example.
They're a great example for this. So.
Yeah, they're a great example of using what you got, right? You know, the Rays have been dealt a pretty poor hand with financially speaking. They're, I think, the fourth lowest in the MLB in payroll.
Something around that.
It's something like that.
But I do want to point out that Stu Sternberg, back when we were under that ownership, obviously we haven't seen the payroll with this new ownership, and we have a feeling it's going to stay the same until that new stadium. But the Rays had spent the second least amount of money that they brought in from sales among any team. The Mets were number one with, I believe, 80% of the money they spent or they earned going into their back into their roster, and the Rays were only around 40%. So what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I mean,
it's just, I feel like it's just kind of an old story at this point.
Yeah, we've, like,
we're
it's
so
tale
used
as
to
old
hearing
as time.
About it. Yeah.
It's I mean, growing up as a Rays fan, you kind of just get used to the heartbreak of like losing
Seeing
guys that you
lose,
love.
Just,
the thing is, with being a fan of a smaller, financially less well franchise, is you can't buy a jersey. Like you really can't buy a jersey unless it's a long term player, which is usually rare, comes around every once in a while. You know, a superstar such as Randy or Rosarena.
Yeah. And then he'll still leave three seasons later, and
exactly.
It won't be his choice. And you know he wanted to stay. I mean, it's
without a doubt.
It's we talked about it earlier, but you know, if you're in the crowd in your section of a home game after you got traded
that was named after you,
it's just, I mean, there's no denial that he wanted to stay here, and I even think that he might come back, but that's a conversation for a whole nother day.
Oh, I would love that.
I want to get into some college football. I know you were at the USF game last night, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to point out how honestly disappointing of a season Texas has had. Mm-hmm. They only won, I believe it was 19-16 against 16-13. Against Kentucky last night. What are your thoughts on Texas and how they've been playing, you know, with a lot of hype going into the season with Arch Manning?
Texas, obviously, and, you know, anyone can see this, but they're underperforming, at least to the expectation. Arch Manning is playing not like he was last year as a backup, or even 2 years ago as a backup behind Quinn Ewers. He doesn't have as many weapons as Quinn Ewers had, and, you know, the system changes every year just slightly, especially in college football and the transfer portal.
Yeah.
But yeah, they are not performing at all to what the original expectation was. And, I don't know. They could be doing much better. I do think they will heat up towards the end of the season. I don't think Sarkisian will allow this Texas team to, kind of just like sputter out and fail. I do think that they will see some success nearing the end of the college football season, at least, with their unranked opponents. But I do think that any ranked opponent they will face, they will probably lose.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to get into a few matchups here, and then we'll talk about that USF game that you had the honors to go to last night.
Yeah.
So we have Vanderbilt beating LSU, ranked number 17 Vanderbilt versus number 10 LSU. They beat them 31-24.
That was pretty crazy.
Number 9 Georgia beat number 5 Ole Miss, another considered upset based on the rankings. Georgia won 43-35. We've got Ohio State absolute landslide over Wisconsin, as it should have been, 34-0. Indiana beat Michigan State 38-3. We have UAB actually beating Memphis Number 22, Memphis, 31-24.
Which, that, do you understand what that means? That, so...
USF Bulls.
Yep. So, with the USF Bulls winning last night, not to distract from that, the USF Bulls winning last night, there was a discussion about who the top G5 school in the nation was, right? Whether it was Memphis, Old Dominion, USF, Tulane, or Navy. And now Navy and USF are tied in the American Athletic Conference, both 6-1. But I think after last night's performance versus FAU, USF absolutely blew out FAU. It wasn't a game past the third quarter.
As I predicted it would be.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was their homecoming game. You never typically schedule a hard team for your homecoming game. But they beat them 48-13. You know, there's no just turning your head away from that.
There was no competition, really. It was just...
Yeah.
It was just a great team against a bad team. That's what it was at the end of the day.
Yeah, and USF was ranked number 19th in the nation. We expect to see some sliding due to that. And also, with some other big upsets, like Miami losing to Louisville, that all has implications as to where USF will end up being placed in the college football rankings. I expect them to be somewhere around 14 or 15 now after that last night's win. Obviously, you have to take into account the fact that the committee decides based on how they won and what other games were played. A game that was an incredible game to watch, though, which some would disagree with, was the Alabama versus Tennessee game.
Oh, yeah.
It ended up in 37-20 Alabama. Alabama did have the spread covered by a touchdown. But it was a very... I want to say an offensive game for both teams, but it was also a pretty good defensive game for both teams. Both defenses showed up. They made plays when they needed to. Obviously, Alabama's defense, they had that key interception in the end zone from Joey Aguilar off the tight end or right to close off that second or first half. And I feel like they really set the tempo from there. They had that game won going into the second half because of that big play right at the end of the first half. But overall, it was a very interesting game to watch. Both teams, even though they struggled at points, they never really gave up, and they played a good game of football, and it was good, interesting to watch.
And how about Utah versus BYU? A three-point game there where number 15 BYU actually won 24-21 over number 23 Utah.
I expected the margin to be a little bigger, but they are both ranked teams. And I mean,
from what I can tell, that was a pretty good game. You know, I didn't get to watch it myself.
Oh, definitely.
But, you know, any game that's going to end in a three-point margin is almost always going to be a good game unless it was a last-second touchdown by the team that lost.
Mm. But going back to that University of South Florida Bulls game last night, Byron Brown had a great game. He rushed the ball when he needed to, but he wasn't opting out to the rush immediately every single second. A lot of rushing quarterbacks, especially underdeveloped rushing quarterbacks you see in college football, they rely on the run too much. If they don't see a play downfield, they don't let the receivers develop the routes. They just immediately scramble and try to make a play with their legs. Byron Brown was dropping back. He looked comfortable in the pocket last night. He was getting out to the flat. He was extending plays, and he was throwing the ball downfield and getting it into the arms of receivers when he needed to. He really didn't force the ball anywhere it didn't need to be. It was a clean game by the USF offense, and they really just came out on top early, and that's what put it away.
Is that all you have for that USF game?
That is. I did get to go on the field after the game. That was very fun. A memory I will
hold on
to.
How about 2 in the morning running around on Raymond James, huh?
Yeah, I was. I sent Jake a few pictures around the 1 a.m. mark when I was on the field. That was because we were doing post-game coverage through the sports web, and we just happened to be in the stadium and go on the field, take some pictures. And
now getting into the Bucks game, all right? I have a few keys to the game. You know, we've got some predictions for the entire NFL, but let's get into the Bucks first. Do you have anything that you want to say regarding the Bucks game? Any predictions, anything that you want to watch out for?
Obviously, the news yesterday, Mike Evans and Emeka Egbuka are both at practice. It's not determined yet whether Emeka Egbuka is going to play. He's a game-time decision as far as we know currently. Mike Evans is expected to play, though.
Mike Evans is considered a pre-game-time decision, which I assume means that sometime throughout today we will figure out whether or not he'll be playing.
Most likely, or very early Monday morning.
You know, and we're already knowing that he's expected to play unless, you know, a setback or he wakes up a little sore, he will be playing.
Yeah, most likely. That's kind of the expectation, especially if he wants to get back on track for that 11th, 12th, 1,000-yard season.
Now, I have a note about that. Mike Evans is 78.2 yards per game away for 1,000 yards, assuming that he plays this week. Do you think he can get to that?
He would need 860 yards through 11 games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's possible. I think he could. I don't think he'll get 76 yards per game. I think he'll have some games where he has 175 yards and other games where he might have 40 or 50.
But those are the games that gets you it. You know, those big breakout games, you know, it allows you to have those 50, 40-yard games.
I think if he gets close to it, it's going to be just like it was last season where it could come down to the last 2 minutes of the final game of the season, the regular season. And I don't know. It really is up in the air right now. I think he can accomplish it. I do genuinely think Mike Evans, the talent's all there. Baker Mayfield's talent's all there. You know, it's nothing he hasn't done before. The only caveat to that being, you know, this is the second season in a row where he's coming back from a hamstring injury where he missed multiple games. These are the longest stretches of his entire career where he's missed multiple games. And so that's the only thing that I feel like could affect it, that mental aspect. But he's headstrong, and I think he, you know, will be able to stand the test of time.
And I want to touch on that, you talking about how he missed games last season. And I don't have a specific stat for it, but I want to remind you and remind everybody at home listening that Mike Evans last year, you know, you take a look at before the season, Chris Godwin was really taking over as that wide receiver one, and Evans was kind of in that scenario where he wasn't getting the ball as much. And then you take a look at when he came back from that injury. Obviously, he was coming back as the wide receiver one, which might not be the case this year with Emeka Egbuka. But you take a look at what he did when he got back into that role coming back from the injury. You could tell he was healthy. He was getting targeted a lot. You know that they wanted him to get it, and they got him it. Do you think that'll happen again, or do you think it'll be a scenario where they're kind of not focusing on it as much?
I think they're going to focus on it, but if it seems unachievable by, like, I don't know, the 10th?
Yeah, if it gets up to where he needs, you know, 100 yards a game, unless he gets two games of, like, 175 yards, I think they're just going to let it go.
Yeah, like, I think Mike Evans is mature enough as an individual to kind of understand that, you know, the game isn't about him at the end of the day. And he said that before. He said that in interviews that, you know, the record is a motivator for him, but it's not the driving factor in why he plays football still to this day at his age in the NFL. He does want to secure another ring more than anything in the world, I'd imagine. And, you know, he wants to get that ring for Baker and the rookies. And so I think he's going to be focusing on playing good football, and as an effect of that, he might get that 1,000th yard season.
Now,
I think if Baker Mayfield puts the ball up in the air consistently enough, though, I think it's completely possible.
Now, that brings up a question that I have for you. Now, do you think with Mike Evans, you know, we'll bring up a scenario, Justin Herbert style, if he doesn't get this 1,000 yards, do you think that'll affect the morale of the team in any way? Do you think some guys will be a little bit, you know, disappointed and feel like it was kind of their fault maybe? In a sense?
No, I actually don't, because I think a lot of the guys on the team are congratulatory of Mike Evans when he gets these records, but I don't think they're going to hold it over his head when he's not. I think it's going to be, you know, 10-second memory, move on, next season. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can agree with that.
I don't think that it's going to be a concern. I think it's going, for the front office, I think for Jason Light especially, he might be a little, like, bummed just because, you know, like Mike Evans was his first ever draft pick. You know, he holds him to a very high standard.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I don't think it'll necessarily,
you know, bring the morale of the team down.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I think that I have some keys of the game, and my number one key of the game for this Tampa Bay Buccaneers team is to contain number 97 on that Lions defense. That is Aiden Hutchinson. You know, I think if you're the Buccaneers, you've got a game plan to do whatever you can do to stop the guy. You've got to double him, put a running back, have him chip block, have a tight end chip block him every single play, but you know he is going to be going up against Charlie Heck. And we saw it just a season ago when he went up against Justin School. You know, it's a different player, but it's still the same scenario. It's a backup. You know, you've got to stop Aiden Hutchinson. And with the line secondary banged up, if you can figure out a way to get the ball downfield, especially with Mike Evans expected to play, you know, that brings me into my second key of the game. But what do you think about that first one?
Yeah, if you can stop Aiden Hutchinson, obviously last year Aiden Hutchinson was the biggest problem for the game with the Buccaneers before he got injured. Aiden Hutchinson, he had like three or four sacks that game. Obviously, like he said, he was going against Justin Skewell, who was a backup offensive tackle to Luke Getteke. But now we have Charlie Heck, who is, I would argue, is better than Justin Skewell, although Justin Skewell is the starting right tackle in Minnesota currently.
I believe he's stepping in for...
Starting.
Is he?
Yeah, he's the starting right tackle.
I thought he was stepping in for, I believe, Christian Benford. I believe his name is... That doesn't sound right, actually, but...
Yeah, well, I think if Aiden Hutchinson can... I don't think there's much of stopping Aiden Hutchinson, necessarily. It's already starting. You're good. But... I think if you can get Aiden Hutchinson stopped, you can have a successful day on offense, especially as the Buccaneers, who can extend plays, get the ball to the outside. You know, they have a creative play design under Josh Grizzard. I think that Aiden Hutchinson is the biggest.
He's a beast of a player.
He's
one of the best edge rushers in the game. And with my second key of the game, you know, if you can stop Aiden Hutchinson, you've got to get number 13 the ball. Find a way to get the ball downfield to Mike Evans, you know, coming back from his injury.
Get the ball out quick, too.
And he's going to be your best playmaker in that game, assuming that Emeka Egbuka doesn't play, which, you know, it's 50-50 right now, I believe. But Mike Evans, if you can find a way to get him the ball downfield against this extremely banged-up line secondary with not one starter on the team, you're going to find a way to win that game.
Yeah. Do you have any other keys to the game?
I have one last one. And, you know, we've watched this Tampa Bay Buccaneers team, and we've watched, you know, I haven't watched too much of the Lions, but we know that both teams do not turn the ball over, rarely ever. And I think whatever team can force a turnover in this game is going to win the game. And I think with the Lions secondary banged up, if, you know, we can find another Jamel Dean interception, which in any other season, if you said, would sound... like I was just talking crazy. But this season, you know, he's, I think, tied for fifth in interceptions, which it's early in the season, so a lot of guys are sitting at one or two. But, you know.
I think another key to the game, and this is just me building on top of that, is time of possession. If Bucks can hold time
Absolutely.
Of possession and run the clock down in the big moments, if they have the lead, I think that they win the game. Just because, you know, their brand that they've been playing this year is, you know, put points on the board, hold the offense on the other side to a minimum of points and secure a win in that last final drive. Even if that's not the original intention going into the game, that's how they played out. And so if Todd Bowles and Josh Grizzard and Baker and the offense can build on top of that mentality, I think it'd be very beneficial for, you know, the Buccaneers. And I think there's a realistic shot that the Buccaneers come out of this game, come out of Detroit Field with a victory. Do you have any NFL news you want to talk about before I quickly take a break to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning?
No, go ahead.
Well, just to give you a wrap-up on what the Lightning have been doing this season, the Lightning are getting off to a fairly slow start. They show signs of good, fast offense. They get the puck into the net in the big moments, which isn't a surprise considering that, you know, the Lightning usually lead the NHL in scoring. The biggest and most noticeable issue with this season's team is a lack of hard defense, all right? The Lightning give up just about, if not more, as many big goals with poor defensive play as they acquire on offense, all right? The keys to success for this Lightning team: tighten up the defense. Obviously, it's very easy to say that, but personally, I would bump up shift Connor Geeky past the fourth line, and I would make the most of power plays. They are very, very, very poor at taking advantage of power plays. I think if they could seize their opportunities in power plays more and just swarm the goaltender, they could realistically come out with these games as wins, because a lot of these games, like even against the Capitals when they were playing Vetchkin, they were in the game until overtime. They went into overtime and then they lost by one shot. And so if they tighten that defense up, they play a little bit better, then, you know, they win.
I think you said it perfect there. Now, I want to get into some NFL picks, and just to recap on last week, I want to talk about what we had last week, and we're going to keep track of this throughout the entire season now. I'm going to highlight just the games that we had differences in. So, you had the Arizona Cardinals to beat the Indianapolis Colts.
Yeah, and that, I wanted an upset.
That did not happen.
It was closer than people thought.
Yes, but the Colts still came out with the win, so yeah. That's a point for me. And then
I will say, though, Jacoby Brissett, I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep interrupting you. Jacoby Brissett did have a better game than Kyler Murray has been playing this season.
He did.
Which I predicted.
He did. Now, you also had the Cleveland Browns to upset the Pittsburgh Steelers, and that was also wrong.
That was awful. Yeah. No, I shouldn't have said that.
I mean, it's not looking too great for you so far, but yeah, we will go to a positive side. I had the Dallas Cowboys to beat the Carolina Panthers, which they did not. So, a little bit of a comeback for you.
Bryce Young had a great game, and that's just what I predicted. So,
and then we're going to go right back to you losing, all right, with you having Jacksonville beating the Seattle Seahawks, and what we had is a game of the week.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
it ended up being a fairly good game.
Yeah.
But
it was probably the best matchup of the week. A pretty weak matchup to week, you know?
Yeah. I do think that Trevor Lawrence if he has the right weapons and the right, you know, headspace, I think he's undefeatable, dude. Like, he's so good. But he lacks consistency. That's the biggest thing he lacks, is just consistency. And you need that if you want to be a franchise quarterback.
So the current score is, I am up 10-8 against you on the season. We will keep track of that throughout the entire season, and we will keep you guys updated. Now we want to move on to our picks for this week.
All right. So for this week, the 9:30 a.m., the London game that was played, and this being actually played right now.
I believe it's at halftime.
Yes. I had the L.A. Rams winning. You had the Jacksonville Jaguars winning. The Rams
and it's looking pretty horrible for me right now.
Yeah.
Looking pretty bad.
New Orleans Saints at Chicago Bears. We both had the Bears winning that. Miami Dolphins at Cleveland Browns. We both had the Dolphins winning that. The Las Vegas Raiders at the Kansas City Chiefs. We both had the Chiefs winning that.
Of course.
The Eagles at the Vikings. We both have the Eagles taking that. The Panthers at the Jets. We both have the Panthers taking that. The Patriots at the Titans. We both have the Patriots taking that.
Now, before you move on to these 4 o'clock games, I want to highlight, just as you listen through, listen to these matchups that are happening from 4 o'clock all the way to Monday night. I mean, the times, you know, every single game that starts at 4 o'clock, I believe is a great game to watch. And I think almost any of these games would have been better than any of the games that played last week.
Without a doubt, yeah. They really did cook with the schedule. It's going to be a good one to watch. The New York Giants at the Denver Broncos. I took the New York Giants. You took the Denver Broncos in Mile High. I can see that. Looking back on it, I can see that.
The Giants are a pretty banged up team. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah,
the Giants have had a lot of injuries. I believe their offensive line coach isn't even traveling with the team due to an injury or a sickness. So it's an entire thing right now.
Yeah. Well, the Indianapolis Colts play at the Chargers. I had the Colts. You had the Chargers. The Green Bay Packers are at the Arizona Cardinals. We both had the Packers. The Washington Commanders are at the Dallas Cowboys. We disagreed on that. I took the Commanders. You took the Cowboys. Once again,
I'm riding with the Cowboys this year.
The primetime game at 8:20 p.m. It's Atlanta Falcons at the San Francisco 49ers. We both have the San Francisco 49ers taking that victory. And for Monday Night Football, your very own Tampa Bay Buccaneers are at Detroit in Ford Field.
Which we have as the game of the week this week.
We do have as the game of the week. It's going to be a competitive matchup
playing. An injured wide receiver room versus an injured defensive back room. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that, watching a bunch of backups go up against each other.
It's like watching the 2008 Patriots defense. It's like it's like no name. But yeah, we both have the Buccaneers taking that
victory. Absolutely. And then, I want to point out that the Lions are 5.5-point favorites on that game.
Which is awful. I don't think they should be.
I think that's unbelievable. I think
if you're looking at raw talent, the Buccaneers do have more talent.
And I think if you even look at injuries, you know, I think the Bucs matchup-wise go up against better. I think, you know, Aiden Hutchinson going up against the injured weak side, right side of the line helps the Lions a lot. But then you take a look that their entire secondary is going to be out. I mean, how do you even... You know, with Mike Evans expected to be back, even if you don't think Emeka Egbuka could come back, how do you believe that the Lions are 5.5-point favorites against the Buccaneers? It's just, I don't believe it at all. You know, there's no reason for it.
That's pretty wild. And there's another game on Monday Night Football.
I hate it.
I don't like multiple nights, or multiple games on one night for a primetime game, Thursday or Monday, because it takes away the special feeling or like the primetime feeling of that one game. It makes them feel less important. Almost. I don't know why. But at 10 p.m. after the Bucs game, the Houston Texans are at the Seattle Seahawks. I took the Houston Texans to beat the Seattle Seahawks. You took the Seattle Seahawks to beat the Texans.
Couldn't agree with that at all.
Why not?
The Texans just do not impress me at all. You know, their defense has played good. Yeah, you know, you've got Derek Stingley. You've got Danielle Hunter, Will Anderson.
Nico Collins is on an incredible run this season.
Yeah, but, I mean, take a look at that offensive line.
They're coming off a bye.
I just don't see it at all. I think, you know, the Seattle Seahawks team has, you know, to me at least, played up to their expectations. I believe they were going to be a very good team. I believe in Sam Darnold a lot, as I do with, you know, Baker Mayfield and how Geno Smith resurrected their careers. I believe that Sam Darnold was going to step in and play like he did last year, even though it's, you know, maybe you could say a little bit of a worse system. But, you know, I think the Seattle Seahawks are just going to take the game away. I think it'll be a little bit closer than I might be explaining it to be right now, but I still think it's going to be, you know, a 24-17 game. Give me the Seattle Seahawks though.
Yeah, and that wraps up our, you know, choice segment of picking the NFL schedule. But yeah, that is an incredible slate of games.
Absolutely. You know a great place to watch that as well? Down here at Ferg Sports Bar and Grill, which is America's number one local sports bar, as voted by USA Today.
Yep. And that's where we broadcast all of our radio shows from, and we're extremely appreciative of them letting us use this studio. Yeah, nothing beats Ferg Sports Bar and Grill on a primetime Monday Night Football.
Or even, you know, come down here at 4 o'clock and watch these games, because, I mean...
Come down here at 2 a.m., you'll find someone.
The entire slate of NFL games this week is absolutely amazing. I haven't taken a look at the Week 8 schedule, but I'm hoping it's at least close to what it is this week. Now, I want to get into some MLB here. The Rays, you know, do you have any updates with the Rays?
Even
though it's the slow part of the offseason, you know, playoffs are going on, Rays aren't in it.
It's a slow part of the offseason, but there is a little news regarding 8 players who will retain rookie eligibility going into the 2026 season.
This is big.
Yeah, this is
big for the Rays, you know, especially with how the Rays operate.
Yes. So, and just to remind anyone listening at home, maybe doesn't watch a lot of baseball or isn't familiar, a player keeps their rookie status if they have less than 130 at-bats or 50 innings pitched. So that's...
And I believe also there's a certain amount of days that you can be on the roster, and then
yes,
it,
I think
it
it's
also
30.
Kicks.
I think it's yeah. I think it's 30. Active
I believe
days
that that sounds yeah.
But there are 8 players on the Rays who will retain rookie eligibility. Number one is Bob Seymour, which is good.
That's good.
2, Brian Van Bell, Carson Williams, who was that shortstop.
That's an amazing. That's an
I'm
amazing.
Very
for
happy
us.
About Carson Williams. Cole Wilcox, Forrest Whitley, who I was also very happy about. Forrest Whitley, the RHP. Garrett Acton, Joe Rock, and Tristan Peters.
I think, you know, obviously you take a look at a guy like Carson Williams and you say that's the biggest one, but I want to get into a little bit of a sleeper there. And, you know, you take a look at the pitcher, and he is the last guy from the Blake Snell trade, and that is Cole Wilcox.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, him retaining rookie eligibility? Do you think there's still a little bit of a chance that we can come out with at least something from that Blake Snell trade?
I think so. I think, you know, that was one of those trades where the Rays made it to get rid of a financial issue. And so I don't think it was one of those trades where they were exactly expecting, you know, a gold mine to come out of it. But I do
think they did.
I do think Cole Wilcox has a shot you know, this season. I'm not going to say that he's going to perform a certain way, but he has a shot. He has a clear shot. He has an opportunity, and if he seizes it, he could be very successful.
The way I see it is, you know, you take a look at what the Rays did later in the season. You know, the playoffs were out of reach. You know, after, I think as soon as we got to September, you could honestly say the Rays were not making the playoffs and be confident with it. You know, you take a look, and the Rays just started shuffling a bunch of pitchers in on the 40-man roster, and they didn't really cut any of them, which was a little surprising to me. You know, you got, like, people like Jesse Sochans who came up, and, you know, I doubt any Rays fans even heard of him, you know, traded from the White Sox. I think that a guy like Cole Wilcox might be end up one of those last cuts on that 40-man roster who, you know, don't even end up making it to December on the team because the Rays have so many players on the 60-day IL that they have to bring back and get down to 40 by sometime in early to mid-November. And, you know, there's just so many different factors that I just don't know if there's even a chance for him to keep playing for us.
Yeah, well, in other news with the Rays, you know, he's gone now, but Stuart Sternberg, all right?
Yep.
On his way out, per The Athletic, it was reported that Stu Sternberg gave cash bonuses to every full-time Rays employee following the selling of the team.
That's amazing.
Over 500 employees in total, and the lowest bonuses he handed out were in the $25,000 to $50,000 range.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the Tampa Bay area,
it costs Stu overall tens of millions of dollars.
You know, and I think you can give him credit and you can take away credit there, you know, saying that he's probably a multi-billionaire at this point following the sale, you know, but you also take a look and he didn't have to do that.
He didn't
go out there and say that he was going to do it. He didn't, you know, you can assume that he didn't do it for publicity.
Mm-hmm.
So you can appreciate that. And I know a lot of people in the Tampa Bay area hate Stu Sternberg for a lot of the things that he's done and a lot of the, you know, stadium kind of area questions that he's done and, you know, mentioning Montreal, which we should honestly ban that word in this studio. But, you know, that's the last time we'll say that. Now, I have an update regarding a Rays pitcher that had a horrible injury that everyone was scared for, and it's Hunter Biggie. Now, he was caught pitching in a game, I believe. Do you know where it was? I might have been the Dominican Republic, somewhere. It was one of those, you know, minor kind of baseball leagues, but he was pitching in a game, he closed it out, and he looked phenomenal, you know? He looked back up to his true self. He had a lot of energy. I don't know if you saw the clip, but after, you know, he was pumped up, he was screaming, he was having a great time.
No, I actually didn't see that clip.
It was pretty exciting to watch.
Well, do we have any other news regarding the Tampa Bay Rays in the offseason so far as we speak? I don't think so.
I do, actually. So
you do.
The Arizona Fall League is currently going on, and that's a league, for anybody that might not be familiar, where, you know, a bunch of prospects get onto a team, and every single prospect, so I'm not quite sure exactly what the team is, but I believe there's six teams, and every team is made up of five prospects, or five different teams' prospects, and I have some key players from the Rays here that I want to read out, and, you know, so I have two key hitters, and then I have three key pitchers, and one of them is really interesting, so I want to get to that, but we'll start off with Braylor Guerrero, who is playing in the Arizona Fall League. He's a guy to keep an eye on. He is the top Dominican signing that the Rays had just a year ago. You've got Aiden Smith, who I'm wearing a jersey of right now, came from the Randy Arozarena trade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a player that you definitely want to keep an eye on, because if we don't get something from that Randy Arozarena trade, some fans might just quit watching baseball or move on to a different team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, moving on to the pitchers, I've got Jackson Baumeister, a guy that I'm actually personally really high on. He came from Zach Eflin just a year ago at the trade deadline.
Yeah.
And then also Andrew Lindsay, coming from the Vidal Brujan trade, who has had a phenomenal last two seasons in the Rays organization. You know, if the Rays are able to even get a serviceable MLB player from Vidal Brujan,
I was about to say,
some of these guys,
I completely forgot not only that we acquired them in the trades, but who we gave up for them.
Sometimes it's so impressive.
Like, Vidal Brujan,
that's a relic of a name at this point.
In 10 years' time, that will be ball knowledge. Like, it's pushing ball knowledge as we speak.
And, you know, if you told me, this is kind of unnecessary hate, but if you told me that Vidal Bruján wouldn't be on the roster and Taylor Walls would be in the big year of 2025, I would not believe you. It's incredible how he's managed a way to stay.
If you had told me
roster.
Taylor Walls would have been in the roster and not Randy Arozarena, I would have probably started crying.
I would have thought Randy Arozarena was on the 60-day IL, and that's how he is on the roster.
I would have thought he died, probably.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's unbelievable. But now, this kind of brings up a topic, and the last pitcher I have is Mason Oyer, and if that sounds a little weird to anybody listening back home, he used to be a former outfielder for the Rays, and he was drafted in his first year. He actually climbed his way up the prospect charts because he had an amazing season. I believe he had over 300 with around 20 homers and a lot of stolen bases. But this last season, I believe it was actually the last two seasons now, last season and a half, he really, really struggled as a hitter. I think I believe he hit, 220. He probably was getting close to getting cut. Mm-hmm. Former early round pick. It was the top three. I believe it was a competitive balance round pick. And, Mason Oyer, now a pitcher. Do you have any thoughts on him switching to a pitcher, coming from an outfielder after struggling as a hitter?
Well, you've seen players switch positions before and perform well at the positions. I mean, if you've watched the movie Moneyball, you've seen it. But I don't quite know how I feel about an outfielder going to be a pitcher unless he's pitched before. Which I imagine he must have had to do this.
I mean, take a look at Brett Phillips. Brett Phillips had never pitched before, and he was making an attempt to switch to a pitcher. But I also believe with Mason Oyer being younger and still considered a prospect, I think it's a lot better for him to make this switch early, realizing that hitting might not just be for him, and because he's got a lot more time to develop now.
The only difference between Brett Phillips and Oyer is the tenure in the league. Brett Phillips kind of had the authority.
It was kind of a forced scenario, in my opinion. He probably had no, or we know this, he had no interest of getting signed by any MLB or MILB team.
Yeah.
So he was kind of like, you know what? A lot of people enjoy watching me pitch. A team will sign me if I go to pitch. I've had a cannon of an arm in the outfield. I believe he touched up to 97 miles an hour in his first pro game with the Yankees, but now has been cut and has formally retired.
Yeah, which, man, I love Brett Phillips. Can't get enough of Brett Phillips.
It's sad, but you know what? If he believes it was the right time, a lot of great moments he brought us. Mm-hmm. Just absolutely incredible.
Yep. Well, we're coming to a close on Between the Lines. We appreciate you for tuning in. Do you have any closing remarks that you would like to make before we wrap up this morning's show?
I mean, the only thing I've got is go Rays, go Bucks, and go USF Bulls.
Heck yeah. Quickly before we wrap things up, I would like to make a quick report on the Tampa Bay Rowdies. They played a match yesterday versus Hartford Athletic at home and ended in a 3-2 score victory. The Rowdies' next match will also be held at home on October 25th versus Detroit City FC, which should prove to be a competitive game. The Buccaneers play a Detroit team this week, and the Rowdies play a Detroit team next week. I think that's
we've got to make it out to a Rowdies game.
I think we do. We have to. They're electric.
Get some content out there.
Yeah, the community always shows out. If you've never been to a Rowdies game before, I mean, it is a different type of energy. It's like you didn't even know that you live among these people.
Yeah.
They come out there with face paint and horns and giant drums and flags. And I mean, Rowdies games really are an experience. And the Rowdies are another team that were acquired in that deal. Patrick Zalupski bought the Rays team for, which were packaged with the Tampa Bay Rowdies. And the Rowdies are a great team to watch. They haven't had a whole lot of success this season, but, in the moments that they do, it's very fun to watch, very fun to be there. I believe that's going to be it for us today from Between the Lines. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you listened, you can find us every week, every Sunday from 11 to 12 here live at Free Sports Bar and Grill on YouTube and on RadioSaintPete.com. Once again, thank you for tuning in, listening to Between the Lines. I'm Tristan with my co-host Jake, and we will catch you next week.
Have a fantastic weekend and a fantastic week ahead.